Hi, this is Jim Gillespie, America's premier commercial real estate coach, located on the web at commercialrealestatecoach.com. Welcome to this month's $1 Million Commercial Real Estate Agent Inner Circle Teleseminar. Today's teleseminar is titled Becoming a Master at Getting Exclusive Listings, and let me tell you what we're going to be doing today on our call. I'm going to be interviewing our special guest, Brad Lester, and our teleconference will go for approximately 1 hour and 30 minutes tonight. So, with that being said, let me get into my introduction for Brad. Brad Lester is a seasoned commercial real estate broker who has been a top producer in the downtown LA commercial real estate market for more than 32 years. He is the president of Major Properties, a commercial industrial brokerage firm started by his father, Arnold Lester, back in 1964. And Brad has literally sold millions of square feet of commercial industrial buildings in his marketplace. Some of his more recent transactions include the sale of a $50 million property, an $18,500,000 property, and a $10 million property also. In addition to his success within commercial real estate, Brad has been a guest lecturer at the USC and UCLA Real Estate and Business Schools. He's been a past chairman of the Jewish Federation Downtown Division, and he's on the board of directors and executive committee for the Jewish Home for the Aging. He was honored as being the Man of the Year by the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America for his years of charity work in the LA area, and in addition, he owns racehorses. So with all this being said, please join me in welcoming onto our call tonight, Brad Lester. Brad, thanks so much for being here with us.
Jim, thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor, and I hope that I'll be able to help your listeners in the next hour and a half learn a little bit about what I do.
Yeah, and I listened to your interview with Anthony Behar of your company, and I just went, wow, I just have to interview Brad. And Brad's territory, for everybody listening, you know, the downtown LA industrial market in general and in the commercial industrial market, was my old territory when I was a commercial real estate broker, too. So his company is very well known and, again, started by his dad back in 1964. You know, Brad's been doing it for a long time. He's got his brother Jeff there and a number of other people. And I listened to your interview with Anthony of your firm, and I just went, wow, I have to call Brad, you know, to talk to him about doing an interview, because not only are you hugely successful, but you know, your humbleness and humility, I just went, wow, this is so rare to find in our industry, somebody with humility who's very successful. And I loved the interview and your presentation and your style. And I said, I got to call him up, see if we can do an interview. So I'm thrilled that you're here and we're doing this.
Thanks. I hope I can live up to that expectation, too.
I understand. So, all right. So in addition to the introduction that I just gave of you, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your background in commercial real estate brokerage and, you know, the kind of properties you work on and your territory?
Sure. Okay, so I think you expressed a lot of it. So downtown L.A., most of the districts we work in, and I kind of became an expert in, everything except office. We really don't get involved in office, but we're kind of like having a paradigm shift in our marketplace, especially in the past 5-6 years. Our bread and butter was owner-user SBA type deals forever, but with the change in the marketplace, the urbanization of downtown, our business has changed to a lot of development, speculation, repositioning, adaptive reuse, and selling properties for ground-up development. So our world has changed as downtown has changed, but Major Properties has always been a chameleon to adjust to the changes in the market. Sometimes we set some trends in certain marketplaces, and other times we follow the trends. We try to anticipate a lot of the various changes that will happen in the different districts of downtown. And I would guess that a lot of your listeners are standard brokers that work in a specific market.
Yes.
That don't have the intricacies of downtown, and that's probably some, I'm probably speaking a foreign language, so maybe I could explain it at a basic level. The downtown market is a collection of different districts geographically, and those districts are defined by various industries. And those industries are, I describe them as living, breathing entities. For example, there's a garment district, there's a produce district, there's an electronic district, there's a business district, there's a South Park that evolved over the past 20 years since the introduction of Staples Center, which became the urbanization of downtown. There's central downtown, there's the arts district. So in these various districts, then there's Little Tokyo and the toy district, there's more. And these districts expand and contract like a living organism based on the increase and decrease of the demand for space by that particular industry and the sub-industries in those industries, and they contract because of the growth of other industries that absorb more space adjacent to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really remarkable organism, downtown real estate, and it is something that organically I became an expert at.
Sure. All right.
I hope that didn't
No, I think it's
scary.
I think it gave a good overview, because all the districts that you mentioned, I remember all those districts too. And one thing that I found interesting that you and I chatted about in getting ready for the call was the fact that with all of the technological changes and innovations going on and the internet and buying products online, the garment industry, you know, where so many garments and pieces of clothing have been manufactured, and yes, jeans has always been a staple in that market. You mentioned to me that they've been dealing with challenges with all of this online opportunity, to buy fashion, you know, that way. And I just thought, wow, that's really, really interesting, because it was always such a pulse without anything like that getting in the way. But times have changed, right?
Oh, 100%. The fashion industry has always been a staple of downtown, and I serve the last 4 years. I got termed out on the fashion bid board, and the occupancy of the tenants is down. The ability of them to pay the rents is down, and the market's under extreme pressure, and eventually those properties are going to change hands, and they're going to change uses.
And that's
and
so,
most likely the uses are going to be residential, unless these owners get very innovative, and I've offered them some interesting solutions, and I'm happy to share it with you. The bedrock, or the central area of the fashion industry, most people have heard of the Santee Alley. Santee Alley is three streets long, three blocks. It's the alley between Maple and Wall. And in the alley, there are a collection of stores. And these stores are all cut up, and most of the product that's sold is some type of garment, some type of fashion, shoes, handbags, accessories, a little bit of food. And for most, the most accurate description is most of the product is not that high-end. They have some high-end product, but most of it is very deep discounted product. But today, you could go online and get cheap T-shirts and undergarments and things like that, even for less than what you would pay at the alley.
Mm-hmm.
And the alley was known for getting, you know, some interesting things at cheap prices.
Oh, people would from Southern California would drive there on the weekends to go there to find these deals, basically. Yeah.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Well, a lot of things hurt that market and the entire fashion market. One was the, it's about 8 years ago, there was a raid of a lot of the vendors that were laundering money for the drug cartel.
Hmm.
And that caused the banks that did business in the market to be heavily regulated, and it shut down the entire cash trade of merchandise in these marketplaces, and it still hasn't recovered from that, and they're still under that type of scrutiny.
Gotcha.
In addition to that, you add
I tell you what, Brad. Let's move on to some questions about like getting into the subject matter that we're going to talk about here tonight.
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, that's what you're talking about is fascinating as heck to me. But we got a lot of people not from the territory.
Yeah, no problem.
You know, so all right. So basically, in kicking it off in general, you know, what differences do you typically see in the habits of the top producing brokers within our industry versus the habits of the mediocre brokers?
Well, there's a few things I know that I do. One is work ethic. I was in a friend's office. A matter of fact, I called a friend up. His name's Richard Simon. He owns Rexford.
Time.
He's the chairman of Rexford.
Big time commercial real estate investor. Yeah.
And we know each other for a long, long time. And I called Dick and left a message. And like an hour later, I get a call. Brad, Dick Simon. I said, hi, Dick. How are you? He goes, I'm in Israel. How are you, Brad? How can I help you? I said, Dick, why did you call me from Israel? He goes, Brad, when you call, it's important, and I always return your call. And I learned from that. I learned that you always return every phone call you get, no matter who it is. I don't screen my calls. I don't have a secretary screening my calls. No matter how mundane the call may be or ridiculous, I take everyone's phone call. I do my best to return every phone call the same day before I go home or do it on the way home. And one is creating some really good habits, and that's a habit that I learned from an expert that has been beyond successful. The next thing is I deem clients friends, and I'm not only their broker, I'm their marriage counselor, I'm their financial advisor, sometimes spiritual advisor. So my business is something that's part of my life. It's part of what I do and who I am. I don't look at it as I'm going to work. I'm look at it that it's just another piece of who I am every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are a couple of things that I think I do really well.
That's great. That's great. You know, yeah. The idea that the personal touch where you're responding to people like that consistently. You know, and I think there's a lot to be said about delegation. At the same time, you need to make sure that you're available when it's appropriate so that people know that you care and you're on top of things for them. And let me just mention one thing around this, because I've noticed this lately with some brokers when I call them on the phone. There are some times when I call a broker and I get voicemail, and instead of their voice, you know, telling me who they are and leave a message at the tone, I'm getting a system greeting, you know, from like this robotic voice saying, you have reached, and they mentioned the number, please leave a message at the sound of the tone. And I'm going, why does the broker choose to have a system greeting on this instead of their own voice in their outgoing message? And to me, that's like such a disconnect from the warmth that you want to create with your clients and prospects, you know, when you have the opportunity to create that with an outgoing voicemail message. So I just wanted to mention that in case anybody's doing that either. A lot of times it's on people's cell phones, I notice, okay? So I just think that's something that should be taken care of, because you want the feeling of your warmth and personality instead of a system greeting on the phone. So, all right, so let me ask you another question. Since we're talking about being successful at getting more listings here, you know, what is it in your opinion that differentiates the top most successful listing agents in the industry from everyone else?
Well, I think you build a track record. You have a foundation that you can present to people that you meet, that you're soliciting listings. I think very important point that I make to my agents that I'm teaching and mentoring is that it's more important to listen than talk.
Mm-hmm.
And try to create a commonality with the person that you meet. If you're meeting at their office or their home, study what's in their lobby, what's important to them. You could tell by trophies that they won, if they were in bowling or baseball or football, or what type of pictures they have on the wall is something they're interested in. And using the tools that they give you to create a commonality with them. If you're sitting in their office and they have certain things on their desk, they're giving you tell signs. It's like showing you their hand in a poker. You know what they have. It's really learning your craft to become a master salesman and creating a camaraderie, wrapping your arms around the client, and giving yourself an advantage that your competitor doesn't have. But with that, if you don't have the goods, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know your market. And we are very oriented in our company of being listing-oriented and having the listing. And we push our agents always to be broker representing owners first and getting market share. And the way we do that is we have territories, specific territories, breaking up downtown and the other markets that we also work in. And we demand that our agents become experts in those marketplaces. And how do you become an expert in a marketplace? Today we have all the tools. You could go on CoStar, put up a geographic area that you're working, and look up who is the most active buyers and sellers in that marketplace. Who are the largest owners in that marketplace? And I demand my agents go and meet those people. I don't care if they sit in their lobby for 3 days until they see them. They need to go see them, have a conversation, even if it's for a minute, and hand them their business card and ask them for their business card, and know who the players are in the market that you want to do business in.
Let me touch on something that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and I'm so thrilled to hear you say it, because I talk about this to brokers all the time, that you know, when you're in someone's office and you see what they have on their wall or on their desk, these are the keys to understanding and unlocking their passions, okay? You know, because why else would they have it out there? You know, photo of their spouse, their kids, a plaque, you know, from the Boy Scouts of America because of them being involved in donating money to charity, a photo of themselves with Tiger Woods, something like that. This gives you keys to their passion, and you can just start to ask them questions about this stuff. Oh, you know, tell me about that photo with Tiger Woods. You know, do you like, you know, you play golf a lot? Tell me about that. Their face will light up. They'll start beaming. They'll talk about the experience, and now you're having them feel their passion again with you in front of them as the person who stimulated this. You know, same thing with a photo of their boys or their girls. You know, tell me about your children. You know, what's going on with your children? What do you love about what's going on with your children? You know, and they'll beam about that too. Okay. And it's just go there and know that this is what they want to show to the world because they have it on the wall. And that's just a huge way to show them that you are truly interested in them. And that can really help to lead you to build that kind of relationship you want to have to successfully get the listing.
And a lot of agents aren't, I call myself a gunslinger. I think I could go into a room and really do that off the cuff. But for the agents that aren't, you know, that seasoned or that quick, you can go on Google today and Google the company you're going to see. And most of them have websites now, and you can learn about the person you're about to meet. And you could do some research, and that shows great intuitiveness and ingenuity. You're coming in to see someone to get a listing, and you were able to say, hey, I looked on the website and saw you have a really interesting products that you sell or whatever it is that they do, and I was curious about something, and come up with a question about something that you saw on the website. How did you guys come up with that kind of design for that widget?
Mm-hmm.
What was the genesis of creating that and getting into this business?
Sure.
I mean, people love to talk about themselves if it's something they're passionate about, and use the magic word passion. If you unlock someone's passion, you have an instant camaraderie they're talking about themselves, that lets down their guard and you create trust. And once you have trust, you've unlocked some keys that you have a good opportunity versus your competitors.
I got to tell you a story here, and you may or may not remember the name, but there was a guy that I used to work along with, especially in my earlier years in the business, named Dave Smith, okay? And Dave was your walking, talking, classic, old-school salesperson, okay? And just, he was so brilliant at understanding people mentally and psychologically and knowing how to push the buttons to endear himself to people. And I remember one time that we were, you know, walking and canvassing together, and I'm talking about, you know, since you're in the territory down there, you know, right around between 7th and 9th Street, like between San Pedro and Stanford, you know, which Brad's probably the only guy on the call who's going to understand what that means in downtown L.A. So we're walking along, and the first guy we come to is he's manufacturing, like, powder puffs for makeup applicators, the round sponge applicators. So I'm here, like, in my early 20s at the time, and we're talking to the guy, and Dave goes, wow, he goes, those are amazing. He goes, I bet the women love those. And he goes, you know, my buddy Jim here, you know, he's like in a relationship with somebody right now. You know, I bet she'd love these things. And the guy's face lit up, and he brought out an envelope and said, stuff as many of these things as you want to in here, okay? So, you know, he just wanted to give to us after Dave said that. And then we go a couple of doors down to a noodle manufacturer, and they're packaging the noodles in these plastic bags, and Dave's looking at them on the conveyor belt going, oh my gosh, those things look absolutely delicious. And the president's so excited that he picks up a bunch of packages and hands them to Dave. Then we go several doors down, and you mentioned, like, the produce areas down there, and we got this produce company we're walking in on, and they're putting together fruit baskets. And, you know, I can tell, you know, the guy is busy. He says, we still got several years left on the lease, but he was on the phone talking to somebody. So I walked outside the building, and Dave stayed in there for several more minutes. He comes walking out with a bushel of bananas in his hands, and he goes, Jim, he goes, number one rule of canvassing, never walk away empty-handed, okay? And it was so funny. And then on another day, we go to a trophy manufacturer, and I was playing a lot of golf at the time, and we're talking to the president. He goes, you know, my friend Jim here recently got a hole-in-one. What do you give to a guy who got a hole-in-one? And the guy's face beams, and he grabs this trophy with the number one on it with a hole in the middle to put the golf ball in. And I just thought, this guy's amazing, just in terms of taking an interest and getting people so excited to show him and give him what they do. I mean, it was just no surprise that he was so good at building relationships and closing business. And I just will never forget that, just how good he was at that. And whatever your approach is, you know, find people's passion, show them that you're interested, you know, unlock that passion with you being there as the stimulus that created it, and that can really go a long way towards creating the ideal relationship that you want to have that will lead to more new listings and more new business. So good.
Yeah, I agree with all that.
Yeah.
And I think then the other edge of the coin is being technologically up to date and competitive with your competitors, which means having a database management system on your computer. Keep every name, every email. Back in the day, we didn't have all that, but
I was the first broker
email.
I knew to have a contact management system. Okay, 1990, it was the ACT software. They had nothing for commercial real estate at that time back then, and
yeah, I'd get
teased, you know, by guys in the office saying, what do you need that for? And they'd show me like a rubber band around business cards or index cards. This works fine for me. And I just kind of laugh. I knew where this was all going to go, but they were insistent that the old way was the way to go, you know?
Sure.
So,
I think today you can, today and for sure, I've been doing it for many, many, many years. I collect everyone's email from anywhere I can. We have 40,000 emails on our database.
Wow.
And whenever we get a listing, it goes out to those 40,000. We market to the same 40,000. We're members of Cost Resource, which has now, they just merged with another company, Compass, and they have over 1 million followers that they email to that see our listings. And then, of course, LoopNet and CoStar, which, you know, is countless number of people. Our listings within 30 days are getting at least 50,000 eyeballs on them.
That's outstanding.
That's 50,000 eyeballs that you won't even know who the people are. But to give you an example of the result of that, a gentleman found a listing I had on Pico Boulevard. He was in Thailand, called me from Thailand. We were asking $12 million for this block of commercial property at Pico and Hayworth. He said, how much is it? I said, it's $12 million. He goes, how much is it for a 10-day deal? I said, what would you like to offer? He said, $10 million. I said, great. I said, I'll write the offer and email it to you. So we did a DocuSign. This guy's in Thailand. 10-day deal, $10 million all cash, no contingencies. The seller signed it the next day. The guy flew in 3 days later to escrow to take care of all the documents and wire. And we closed. I've done three more deals with him and working on more with this gentleman from Thailand. So you don't know where it's going to come from today, your business, but you need to also have the ability to mass market your product. And having a listing gives you amazing access to you don't know who in the universe of real estate today.
Yeah.
If you're marketing it properly.
Yeah, and, you know, that's something that's great when you go in to talk to somebody about, you know, getting, you know, trying to obtain the listing, when you can mention, among many other things, that this is your email marketing system, it goes out to this many people, you typically see this many views of your listings. I mean, that's the type of stuff that many brokers aren't talking about, and an owner will listen to those numbers and go, wow, this sounds great, this sounds huge. And as long as you're in the, you know, the running for the listing, that can be one of a number of different things that can help to differentiate you to get the listing, because let's face it, owners are looking at different candidates to list with, and in the back of their mind, they're going, what's this person going to do differently and better than all the other brokers I'm talking to that I believe has a great chance of moving my property quickly and getting me a price that I'm thrilled with, right?
Sure, and you have to be able to tell a story, hopefully a success story, and you have to be able to tell stories. Well, one of my features that I think I'm very good at is reading people and then telling them a story about somebody else, but I'm really telling them about themselves.
Very good. Ooh, we could tell you got 30 years plus of experience here. This is great, okay? Because metaphorically speaking, it's speaking to who they are when you've identified the other story and the metaphor that will relate directly to them and their situation.
It takes time to learn how to do that, and it just, I'm very fortunate that I learned that skill, and I don't really even think about it. It just kind of happens.
Unconscious now. And that's what, yeah. Interestingly, like, you know, good hypnotherapists will do with people. They'll tell a metaphor story to the subconscious mind, and the subconscious mind will make a connection to make the change in the person. And, you and I haven't talked about this, Brad, but I got, like, you know, expert master credentials in hypnotherapy. And when I was in L.A., I got to work with some of the top athletes in the world, you know, helping them with performance enhancement and stuff like that. And the language patterns of a top hypnotherapist are similar in many ways to the language patterns of a top salesperson, in that you're talking to the person's conscious and unconscious mind and guiding them in the direction of an ideal resolution that's best for them. And in sales, the ideal resolution is something that works great for them and something that's great for you as a salesperson also.
Sure. Yeah, I always say I'm trying to convince somebody to do something that's good for them.
Yeah.
And some opportunities are harder than others, but they're all opportunities. I would share a very interesting story of, if I want to regress back to how I got started and became an overnight sensation in downtown LA, if you'd like to hear that.
Oh, please. Yeah.
It's a pretty interesting story. So there's a company called Joe's Parking.
I remember them all around downtown.
You've come downtown, but parked in Joe's parking lot. They also own a company called Wally Park. So I would come downtown as a young man and starting in real estate, and I knew this gentleman that owned a property of 100,000 feet in the Arts District before it was really the Arts District, and he was a janitorial supply distributor. And he would have breakfast every morning at Vickman's, which was the...
I know it well.
Remember Vickman's Deli
Street.
Over on 8th and San Pedro by the produce market?
Yep.
So I would go there, and he sat there with a guy that made metal wire cabinets and another guy that made rubber seals and another guy that made plastic bags. So all these guys were there. They were all industrial manufacturers. He was the distributor. And another guy came in to breakfast about three times out of the week, and his name was Harry Loomer. And Harry Loomer was one of the owners of Joe's parking lot. So we struck up a relationship over time. And one day he said to me, you know, we fired our broker. Their broker was a company called the Donati Group. That's an old name.
Absolutely. Dan Donati and his organization, yeah.
Yeah, and Ron Bago and Ed Eisenberg, I think his name was.
Yes, so, he used to work with Grubb & Ellis.
They had fired them as their broker, and Harry said to me, maybe you want to try to be our broker because we have all these buildings that are empty. And they did. They had about 30 buildings throughout downtown that were just sitting empty, no income, kind of boarded up, and they were all over downtown. They were just such a huge company that I guess they didn't really care that much. So I said, sure, Harry, I'm interested in doing that. So he set up a meeting for me, and I went in to meet with his uncle, Art Loomer. But I wound up not meeting with Art Loomer this time. I met with one of the partners named Gabe Rubin. And Gabe Rubin basically grunted at me and threw me out of the office. He said, if he has a tenant, bring him, and threw me out. It was a very quick meeting, like 30 seconds. So I sat and I thought about it for a few weeks, and after some time went by, and you might not believe this story, but it's a true story. I thought about it, and I said, Harry, you know, I thought about this, and that wasn't your uncle. That was one of the partners. I really want to meet with your uncle. He goes, if you think that guy's tough, my uncle's 10 times tougher. And I said, that's okay. I'm ready for him now. I know what to do. So they gave me an appointment. I went over. They own the Bank of America buildings on Spring Street that they had bought because Bank of America had problems in the 80s. And they moved to San Francisco, so they had 400,000 feet at 7th and Spring, and they had another 300,000 feet. They took the first interstate building that went out. The banks left Spring Street, and they had that building. And so anyway, I went over. They moved their offices into the B of A building, and I waited for an hour until they were calling me in. So this door opens up to the former B of A conference room, and out walk these eight Japanese people screaming, cursing in Japanese. They had just made an offer of $40 million on one of the blocks that the Loomers own between 4th, 5th, Spring, and Los Angeles Street. And Art Loomer told him, if it's worth 40, if you're willing to pay 40, it's worth 44. I'm not selling, and threw him out. So now it was my turn. So they brought me into the room, and they sat me across this giant conference table from Mr. Art Loomer. And on the right of Mr. Loomer was all his family members that had interest in the business. And on the left were eight attorneys because they were in that big meeting with the Japanese. And I guess he decided that he was going to carve me up next after he threw those guys out. So Mr. Loomer said to me in his Eastern European swagger, "So, what do you want, kid? What do you want from me?" And I'm like, "Oh, Mr. Loomer, it's so nice to meet you. I've heard amazing things about you. Sir, what do you want?" I said, "You know, I noticed every one of your buildings, 30 of them, they're empty. You're losing millions a month. He said, so? I said, well, I know why they're empty. You hate brokers. He looks at me. He goes, so? I said, I know why you hate brokers. I said, you hate brokers because they lease your building. You pay them a five-year commission. The tenant leaves in a year. Then the broker wants to lease it and get paid for nothing all over again. The brokers are just ripping you off. He goes, so? What do you want? I said, well, I said, Mr. Loomer, I want to make you an offer you can't refuse. He goes, what? And he's steaming now. He said, I said, yeah, yeah, I want to be your partner, Mr. Loomer. His head almost exploded. He reached across the table, pointed at me, and started screaming, you be very careful what you say, young man. I said, oh, nothing like that, Mr. Loomer, nothing like that. I said, I'll lease your building. If the tenant pays you, send me my 5% commission. If they don't pay you, you don't pay me. We'll be partners. He looks at the lawyers. He looks at his family. He takes his arm and swings it across the room and says, give him everything.
Oh, wow.
So my first year at Major Properties, I got 30 listings all over downtown overnight. And I started doing leases for these people. And they were mailing me checks by computer. So anyway, like, I was into it for a couple years, and I got a check, and the tenant had moved out, and I ran over to see Mr. Loomer, and went to see him, and I hand him the check, and he looks at it. He said, I signed it. Go away, kid. Throws it at me. And I take it, and I throw it across the desk back at him. And he goes, what the hell is wrong with you? I signed it. I said, hey, we had a deal. He goes, what do you mean? I said, you only pay me if the tenant pays you. Your tenant moved out last week. I can't accept this check. He took that check, looked at me like I was crazy, put it in his drawer and threw me out, screaming, get the hell out. The next day, by messenger, I got an invitation to the daughter's wedding.
Wow.
I had proven my honesty and worthiness to the agreement I made with him, and we had a great relationship until he passed away.
That is great. That's an awesome story, Brad. Thank you so much for telling that, especially with the sound effects of his voice, too, okay? But it's just, I mean, that just says so much because, you know, so many other brokers are thinking, well, I got to get the listing, I got to get the checks. If the tenant goes out, that's his problem, not mine. You went into total alignment with the issues and the problems that he's had with brokers and basically showed him that you're different, that you're not about the quick buck and on your way. You only want to get paid if it works for him. You're willing to not get paid when the tenant goes out of business and stops paying him rent. You acknowledge that brokers, you know, can be difficult and, you know, not enjoyable to work with. And it was like an amazing breath of fresh air to this guy who for decades, I'm sure, had this negative opinion of brokers. And now you were the one broker who understood him, who was willing to go and do things differently, and he loved it, embraced you for it, and just handed you the keys to the castle with all of these listings. Congratulations.
Yeah, it was quite something, and it was, you know, it's been a good ride since that. They really gave me an amazing start to my career, but, you know, I came up with something out of the box, and I'm always trying to, you know, figure out what's creative, what's different. I'll tell you about a listing I didn't get, because that's just as important, and how creative my competitor was, and that was actually a Donati group. There was a girl I went to high school with. Her name was Barbara Farish, and she went to work at Donati back in the 80s, and the Rykoff people wanted to sell their property. That's where the smorgasbord is, and
yep. The big
loft development.
Olympic and Alameda
project.
Olympic and Alameda, right?
Yeah, the produce market's on Central, and it goes all the way to Alameda,
yep.
Right?
All right.
It's where Morello Maddox had. It was where American Apparel was.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, they wanted to sell that property. They were interviewing brokers, and she came up with something amazing. She put her marketing proposal in a vegetable can that's SNS that Rykoff sold.
Mm-hmm.
And she went to the meeting and put the can in front of everybody. They looked at her like she was nuts. And she gave them can openers. They all opened the can, and her proposal was in the can. They gave her the listing.
Yeah.
They gave her the listing to sell that property. She came up with something that creative. I give her, you know, and I remember that because I remember I've got to be creative. I have to do things and offer things to be better and more interesting and shocking and creative to my clients that they are going to want to work with me.
This is great. Let me mention a couple of things. I interviewed somebody who you may know, Greg Barsamian, okay, earlier this year. Works in Glendale Market. He's with Colliers right now. And something, you know, Greg's been around for 30-plus years. Great guy. He's been a coaching client. And something that Greg mentions that he does whenever he's going in to try to get a listing for lease is he tells them, he goes, and I want you to know that this listing agreement comes with the Barsamian guarantee. And they go, what's that? And he goes, if the tenant goes out of business at all, you know, during the term of this lease, I will relist it with you, and you don't need to pay me, you know, any commission for my side for the balance of the term that they defaulted on. You know, that's my guarantee to you. And he just says the people love it. He goes, in 30-plus years, I've only had to make good on the guarantee twice, but it's a tremendous asset and selling point going in because now the owners basically say, you know, similar to what you said to Mr. Loomer, you know, I'm guaranteeing this. If they go out, I'm backing you up as the bank on my side, and you don't have to pay me. And again, that can just be huge to certain owners who have had tenants default, and the broker's been long gone with the commission. Let me mention something else. When you were talking about that presentation with the the presentation in the can, I'm not going to mention the person's name just because I don't have their approval to, but a major, major successful woman in brokerage in Southern California. I read an article about a presentation that they made once where they were going in for a really big listing on something, and they basically had all of the people on the team go into the presentation dressed in coordinated safari gear, you know, with the pith helmets and you know, camouflage safari type stuff and make-believe, you know, safari guns. And they go in there, and the theme was basically something like, you know, we're going hunting together as a team to find your ideal tenants for this project, and they ended up winning the listing. While all the other brokers on the other teams are walking in suits and ties and, you know, business suits for the women, and they go in with this idea, and it just basically wowed the owners of this major new project.
That's fantastic.
Isn't that great? Let me mention one thing, just You do know him?
Oh yeah, we have worked on and off together for many, many years.
Great guy. Let me mention just something going back to when we were talking about contact management software, because sometimes people will ask me. So I just want to mention the software programs in case anybody's thinking that they need a good one or they're thinking of switching. So basically, the main programs that brokers are telling me that they are really loving today, the programs that are specifically designed for commercial real estate brokers, are Client Look, which is located at clientlook.com. The next two that basically people talk about are Apto, A-P as in Paul, T-O, I believe it's at apto.com, and then Ascendix, A-S-C-E-N-D-I-X, which I also believe is at ascendix.com. So there are other ones out there, but these are basically the three that among all the commercial brokers that I talk to, this represents probably at least 85% of brokers deciding that they're going to utilize one of these three for the most part. So I just wanted to make sure I got that in. So this is great. Now, let me ask you, okay, so you know, the story you told is great. The kind of things that we're talking about in terms of the building relationships and standing out and differentiating yourself, very, very important. So, you know, knowing that owners are looking at the brokers that are their potential listing agents, you know, how important is it to differentiate yourself and stand out from the pack? And outside of what you've just mentioned, is there anything else that comes to mind that you'd recommend to make sure that you stand out as the best choice an owner could make with who they're going to list with?
Sure. I think that, one, I'll just say that I do what Greg does. That's just standard for myself and my company. We give that guarantee, and sometimes owners have us put it in writing. Most don't. But we will not refund, but we'll credit them an unused, unearned credit if they relist with us if the tenant goes bad. And it's very rare that it happens, but it does happen. I think more than twice for us. As far as other things to stand out, you know, I have a unique perspective on the market because I'm also an owner of about 750,000 square feet. And I use that to my advantage when I'm going in for listings, that I look at property like an owner would look at a property. And I use the teamwork analogies that, you know, we're a team. You're the owner of the company, and I'm your manager. And I'm also, hopefully, your superstar that's going to bring you that tenant or that, you know, top value to sell your property. And being an owner, I understand what owners want when they're looking to lease or sell their property. We vet the tenants. We make sure that this is a tenant that we could rely on that with most certainty will be there through the entire term of the lease. So we try to give them a real comfort level that they're dealing with someone that is kind of like a peer versus an employee or, you know, because people kind of, I don't think all people look down at brokers, but some people look down at brokers. So if you can kind of elevate your status when you're talking to owners and make them feel comfortable, even if you don't own real estate, you know, you have to find some key buzzwords that will, you know, make you stand out. So you either need, you know, the more tools that you have, the more bullets that you can fire, and then if you don't have to fire all the bullets, that's really good, but you should always be armed with an extra silver bullet to help you close, you know, the deal, whether it's getting the listing or making the deal.
I think something that you mentioned and also alluded to earlier through your story, you know, is this idea of conveying that you are somebody completely honest, ethical, and looking out for the owner's or the principal's best interest. Whereas I think so many other brokers can convey the impression that they're really about, you know, trying to make sure that they earn and get paid a commission, and that can sort of seep through in the presentation. But obviously with the story that you told before with Mr. Loomer, I mean, it was obvious that you were different. You know, can you talk about, you know, how important it is to convey that in a presentation and anything else that you think may be important to convey in a presentation too?
Sure. So I had a young man working here, and he door knocked down in the manufacturing area south of Washington around Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And he built up a pretty nice relationship with a guy that owns a lot of property down there. And he was selling him a few buildings, and he got into a negotiation to sell him another building. And this guy really wanted to own everything around him, and they got into a negotiation. The owner, the buyer, good client, was being a little stubborn on paying a little bit too much more than the property was worth. Not that he wasn't willing to pay more, but he didn't want to get totally raped. And the broker, young broker, got a little impatient with the back and forth and the frustration of the deal not going as smoothly as others had, and he kind of tried to push the guy, and the guy threw him out of his office. He goes, you know, whose side are you on, mine or the seller? So, and really he was on both because he was an off-market dual agent, but the reality is he was making all his money through this guy buying properties overpriced because they were next door to, you know, his many, many assets. So he got thrown out, and he came back, and he was, like, typically, he was just in tears. He was like, Brad, what do I do? What do I do? You know, he threw me out. You know, I did this, and, you know, tell me what happened. I said, okay, tomorrow I'd like you to go back to his office, and if you're really smart, you know, maybe you'll pick up a little fruit basket and go back to his office and sit in his lobby. He's probably going to make you wait there about 4 or 5 hours before he sees you because he's really upset with you. And don't worry, he's going to forgive you. When you see him, you'll tell him, you know, I really am sorry. I was very anxious to make the deal, and please excuse me for not looking at it from your perspective, and I hope we can move forward. And I guarantee you he'll forgive you, and he'll wind up doing the deal at the high price. Made him sit there 6 hours, and when he saw him, he gave the apology, and they did the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he did many, many more deals with him, and that was about 8 years ago, and that agent's not with me anymore, and I got a couple of young guys now that are I've sent in there, and they're in the middle of 3 deals with the same guy. So he's been a great client of the company, and you know, you might say that yeah, I could go in there and I know the guy, but I just delegate it. I have a unique philosophy of wanting my agents to make money and trying to lead them in the right direction and guide them, and I delegate a lot of my business to my agents, and that way we could do a lot more business.
See, again, this is why I wanted to have you on the call, okay? It's like,
yeah.
You believe in sharing the wealth and helping people and helping your agents do better, you know, and again, just such a wonderful feeling and attitude. And somebody who I had the great pleasure of working for, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year, Al Rose. Just a great guy, a complete class act. I mean, you know, like around at the founding, you know, days of AIRCRE. And I remember you were talking about the situation in the room where the principal asked the broker, you know, who do you represent? And Al told me a story about a situation that he was involved in his earlier years in the business. And he's sitting in the room, you know, with basically the buyer and the seller and a senior broker, I believe it was, that he was working under at the time as a young guy in the business. And the senior broker is basically, you know, trying to sell the deal to both the buyer and the seller. And one of the principals turned to the broker and said, you know, you keep pitching both sides of this. Who do you represent? You know, me as the seller or this other guy as the buyer? And there was like a little bit of silence, and Al told me the broker said, I represent the deal. You know, and I think in many ways, you know, so many brokers look upon it that way, you know, because you're trying to put the deal together. But I thought it was so interesting that when being asked, you know, do you represent buyer or seller, that he came up with a third entity that was the deal right in front of everybody.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, I mean, in today's world of like making the agency clear, that definitely would not fly, you know, so, but it's funny. So let me ask you a question. So how are you going about getting your leads for your listing opportunities these days?
Well, one, we do tremendous internet marketing. I have a lot of young guys here, and we have them out walking on the streets. I drive with them and drive their areas and help them identify visual opportunities of distress. And they do the research and come up with numbers, and I help them do the calling. My niece is in the company, and she runs our social media marketing. We do massive social media. We have agents that have different blogs, and the same thing we're doing here. And we have videos that we're posting on Instagram, Facebook, and on our website, and other advertising venues.
And the videos that you're posting, what's in the videos?
It could just simply be a group of us going out to lunch. It could be someone in front of their new listing talking about the new listing. Just getting exposure to we don't know who, but just getting more exposure. We're finding that there's a changing of the guard. It's a generational change of wealth going on. especially with a lot of our clients in the downtown market. The sons are taking over the businesses and the real estate businesses as well. So we're trying to be in mediums that they frequent, like Instagram and Facebook, LinkedIn. I have over 13,000 followers on LinkedIn.
Very good.
And we're marketing through all these different online avenues, and we'll get calls. People want opinions of value. We offer free opinions of value. We market that. We're always constantly coming up with new types of marketing, advertising, and finding to get the best exposure for, you know, for the least amount of money to spend. We're making videos for presentations when we go in to get, depending on the size of the listing.
So explain what you do with those videos ahead of time and how you utilize them in the presentation.
Yeah, I made a presentation to get a listing from the Salvation Army on a property they have downtown, and it was a $100 million property. And we created a video showing all the amenities of downtown, Dodger Stadium, Staples Center. We had music to it and some graphics. And then we highlighted their property and talked about, in the video, the different types of national and international connections we had to expose the property.
This is good.
We tailored a video specific for that asset.
Now let me mention something else with that, Brett. Okay, because Greg Barsamian, you know, showed me a wonderful video that he did for a listing he's got out at in Woodland Hills called Warner View Center. And it was basically, you know, again, showing the visuals of the place. And then he would do specific interviews with tenants in the facility talking about how much they love being a tenant there and, you know, set to music and voiceover and stuff like that. But one beautiful thing about that is when you've got one or more of those in the can and already done, you know, when you're going on a listing presentation to somebody where, you know, obviously you can do a video like that in advance, and that can be great. But if it's something where you go, well, you know, let's walk in and show them something that we've done nice on another listing, you can show that to them, and I can almost guarantee you it would be really rare to find any broker going in with a video like that. And you could say, look, you know, and we will do something just like this for your listing because it's a tremendous way to market your property. And again, everything else, you know, being in alignment and you doing the right things with everything else in your presentation, that can be another beautiful feather in your cap to have them say, wow, this is good, this is creative, we should give Brad and his team the listing.
Sure. I've made presentations and told the owner that we're going to tell anybody that brings in a deal that we're going to buy them a car. I mean, the deal was big enough that we could buy someone a 3 Series, you know, for $50,000 out of our, you know, few $100,000 commission, and offer that to a cooperating broker
that
brings in a deal.
Yeah, see, I love the fact that you understand the value of this big picture stuff, of spending big money because of the big money it can bring in. And so many brokers would be like, oh, no, that's like too big of an expense. Look at the massive return that could come from it, not only on this one listing, but in terms of opening the door to a multitude of listings, just like you did with the Loomer family.
Yeah, I think the more creative you are, the more you're willing to put out, that the more that's going to come in. And that gets me to the other venue where I built my business besides with the Loomers and other people in downtown. I did a lot of nonprofit work, and I did it when I started and didn't really have money to give to the nonprofits. But I got involved in some nonprofits where there was very real estate owner supported. So most of the members of the organization and different organizations I was involved in were people that owned real estate. And what I found when I was marketing or soliciting, guy would say, well, I don't have anything here, but I got something there. I never got involved in nonprofits to do business. I really cared about the institutions that I was trying to help out. But what came from being involved and sitting on committees and planning events is that people got to know me and I got to know them. And they, what do you do? It's just natural. Every, you know, people in business ask people what they do. Oh, I got this property over here. Come see me. Oh, yeah, I want to sell it. Sell it for me. Great. Because I cared about something they cared about, and we had passion about it, it just became natural that they wanted to do business with me versus, you know, a name at the, you know, a competitive firm.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, if you can match, like, your interest in doing something with a particular charity, along with that charity be in a place where the ideal decision makers in commercial real estate are spending their time, that's basically a marriage made in heaven in terms of your natural passion and the opportunity to meet these people, you know, in a social context and in a charity caring context that can lead to business. And but you're not going to do it. I mean, like, for example, so many business people go to Chamber of Commerce meetings with the attitude of, okay, I need to get all these people to give me business, but they're not contributing at all. And ideally, if you can get involved on a committee, you know, where you can call people on behalf of the charitable organization and talk to them about things, upcoming events, a special cause that they're looking for donations for, now this gives you the side door entrance to talk to these people about something you both care about, i.e. this charity, and that side door entrance now begins that relationship between the two of you, which puts you in a much better position to be able to develop that into commercial real estate business down the road as compared to you just calling the person cold with no mutual connection like this.
Yeah, 100%. And I've raised, I don't know, I'll be conservative and say I've raised tens of millions of dollars for various charities in this city. And I've donated a lot of money as well, you know, nothing like that, but, you know, significant amounts. And I developed I became a known entity in that universe where, like at the Jewish home, I'll get a call out of left field from a guy that I don't really know that well. Oh, Brad, I know you're involved with the Jewish home and my mother's getting old and can you help me get her in? And that stuff happens. But my point is when I was soliciting people for money for an organization, I had a rule, and I still have the same rule, that I never want to ask a question where the answer is going to be no.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say, hey, Jim, can you give me $10,000? I don't know if you can give me a dollar, let alone $10,000. And I would never ask you that. I got to be more sensitive. And I transformed that into my philosophy in my real estate business. That's a little different than what, you know, some of the Zig Ziglars will tell you, ask for the listing three times. I never want to ask for something that's going to be a no. So I really want to get a little more educated and a little more relationship driven before I make my ask. Not that I don't make my ask, but I really want to be a little smarter than my competition, and I want to be a little more relationship-oriented, and I want to ask a question that is going to be a yes or a maybe, but I don't want the first thing I ask someone to be the answer no. And the answer no the first time is that's the guy I said no to. Someone asked me something. Think about someone calls you up and tries to sell you something and you don't even know them. Your immediate response, no. Mm-hmm. But if someone built a rapport with you and they ask you something, well, let me think about that, Brad. Let me see, you know, we're not ready yet, but I really, so I don't want to ask that. I said, would it be okay if I got you a free opinion of value? That tends to get a lot of yeses. Versus, hey, can I come over and talk to you about selling your property? No,
sure.
I don't want to sell right now. I mean, really, the problem with a lot of the brokers, I mean, we know it's like a 10% make most of the money and 90% don't.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of reasons and the mistakes people make. And what you do right is, it's equally important to say what people do wrong. And what a lot of agents do wrong is they're too anxious. They don't separate themselves from the deal, and they're not professional. They're not taking the time to master their craft, to be patient and nurture the clientele. There's just so many components that go into it of developing your own personality and your own sales techniques. But you got to walk out of a meeting, and if you didn't get the listing and you see your competitor's sign go up on it, you need to be able to go back and look at that situation to find out, well, what did I do wrong, or what are they doing right, or both, and can I change? Because if you can't change, there's nothing more insane than someone doing the same thing over and over the same way, getting the same result, but expecting something different.
Yes, and that is widespread in our industry. I just can't believe the number of brokers who say that they want to be top producers, and they've been locked into this routine that they've been doing on autopilot for years, okay? And then it's like, well, if you're locked into this routine, how are you going to get out of it unless you either take a look at what you're doing objectively and come up with a way to recognize what you're doing wrong and change it, or get some coaching and training to learn what you need to do and the focus and accountability to make the change? Because so many brokers, year after year, the attitude is, no, I don't need to learn anything new. I don't need to make any changes. I'm just going to keep working this same old routine I've been doing for years or decades, and someday the market will recognize the genius in what I'm doing and will respond by suddenly dumping a ton of business on my lap, and I just go, good luck with that.
Yeah, and I'll give you another instance. It's the same subject, but a little different, going in a different direction. I was cold calling on a gentleman, Korean gentleman. He had a really nice building, 70,000 feet down in south of Washington, and we met, and, you know, he liked me, and we were talking, but he said, you know, I got a relationship with one of your competitors, a Korean company, and, you know, they speak the same language, and his English was okay, but not great, and he said, you know, I really like you, though. I'm really in a quandary what to do. So I said, well, I tell you what, you like us and you like him. I said, I'll co-list it with him. It's a great closing tool. Mm-hmm. You've got a guy you like. You know I can get the job done. I don't want to hurt the guy. I said, I'll co-list it with him. Let's just put us both on it. I'm happy to work with him and share the commission. He said, great. He goes, let me think about it.
Yeah.
So he calls me up a few days later. He says, come see me. I come to see him. He goes, Brad, you know, I learned a lot from you. In 1 week, I learned more from you than all my years in real estate. I said, well, thank you. I appreciate the compliment. How can I help you? He goes, I want you to write up the listing. You get the listing.
Mm.
He says, and I want to tell you why. He goes, I called my friend who I've used for years, and I told him that I really want to work with you, and you were willing to co-list the property, and you guys should work together. And he got mad at me and told me he wouldn't work with me no matter what. So he goes, okay. I said, okay, then our business is done, and I'm going to be working with Brad. So by being humble and being cooperative, you know, there's so many brokers that don't cooperate. And I have a passion and a company policy. I said, hey, we want to get listings. We want to move the listings. We want to represent the owners in the best way possible. Cooperate with every broker. Broker brings you an offer, submit his offer. Don't delay on submitting it. Don't shop it. Give everybody a fair shot to make the deal, whether we have our own buyer or not. We have to represent the owner first. And when I go in to get listings, I tell owners that. I said, that's our policy. I said, my job is to get you the best price. And I said, you know, I have my own buyers, but when I'm representing an owner with a listing, those buyers know that I'm going to get the owner the best deal I can. And that's, you've hired me, and you put your trust in me, and that's my job. My job's to get you the best price.
See, that's what you got to do, because if you truly stand for doing what's in the best interest of the client at all times, you know, you're congruent, you're truly serving their best interests, you're being honest, you're being ethical, it feels great, and it will serve you because people are crying out to work with somebody like you as a broker who sees it that way and who will always treat them that way instead of trying to shortcut it in the way that makes them the most amount of money.
You know, and something else I tell them, which, Jim, you might find astounding, you might have never heard this before, and your listeners haven't. Why would anybody sell any property in downtown L.A.? Guy tells me, what do you think? I said, I'll tell you exactly what I think. I own 750,000 feet, and that offer better be worth 10 times what my property is, because I know where the market's going. I'm not a seller, and you shouldn't be a seller, and don't sell your property. You've got a great property. How are you going to replace that property? And I got to tell you, it doesn't matter. They're still going to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
But they appreciate that honesty. I said, look, if you want to sell it, I'm going to get you the best price because this is an amazing market and time. But I tell you, unless you need to sell it, why would you sell it?
Yeah.
There's so many reasons why people sell property, and a lot of them are stupid, and they make a lot of mistakes. But at the end of the day, they're going to do what they intended to do, and I'm happy to help them do it. Thank God they do, or I'd be out of business. I wouldn't even be talking to you, obviously. But really, that I've closed a lot of listings by being that kind of honest, because I've told them, and something very rare, I don't think maybe once someone said, well, Brad, thanks for that, but I don't want, okay, you convinced me, I'm keeping the property. That's never happened. They want to sell it. But it helps me get the listing. I've used that many, many times. What do you think of that, Jim?
I think it's great. And it just, it shows them, again, that you're willing to walk away from a commission because you believe it to be in their best interest to potentially hold on to the property. And they've probably never experienced another broker in their lifetime telling them not to sell when the broker wants to get the listing to sell. You know, and you just remind me, you know, you maybe think of, you know, when I think of like the three salespeople that have been trying to sell me in my lifetime that that I think were just outstanding people that I always wanted to work with and wanted to bring them business and do business with them. You know, one guy was a guy named Tony Furcano, who was a Cadillac salesperson at Martin Cadillac in West L.A., and just so easy, down to earth, not pushing me to do anything. Oh, you want to test drive that car? He tossed me the keys and, you know, go out in the lot and drive it. You know, instead of like, I got to get in the car and ride along with you. And I just went like, this is so cool. I just get to be alone in the car and drive it and no pushing, no nothing. And the other two people that I first met in title and they later got into financing, Larry Zam and Kurt Robinson. And again, it was just all nice, pleasant relationship stuff, not trying to sell me anything, just showing up, how's it going, how's your golf game, how's this, and it just, it's like I just wanted to spend time with these people because they were so enjoyable, and that's who you want to be. You want to feel like a good friend to them that they want to be with, socialize with, talk with, confide with, play golf with, go out to lunch with, whatever, because people want to do business with people who they feel are their friends, and once you begin to occupy that position in their mind that you are their friend, it makes it very difficult for them to ever work with anyone else because nobody wants to do that to somebody they consider to be their friend.
That's right. And then when they think about a real estate issue, your name pops up in their head versus a competitor. And, you know, I had a young man a couple weeks ago in one of our sales training meetings, frustrated because he was getting beat out by one of our competitors. And he said, hey, can I call this owner up and tell him what a jackass and jerk and how bad this guy is, meaning one of the competitors. So I'll give a shout-out to a guy that died a long time ago. His name was Jack Taft. And I worked for Jack when I was really young before I came into real estate. And Jack Taft was a master salesman. And he taught me part of my ability to be a salesman and training. He had a company called Santa Fe Freight, and they competed with Harbor Freight. They imported cheap tools, and sold them. They sold them by telemarketing. And I took a job as a telemarketer. And he taught me sales through telemarketing. But one of the foundations that he told me was never knock your competitor.
Mm-hmm.
Never knock your competitor. A knock is an endorsement of your competitor. Never knock them. So I'd say if someone brought up one of my competitors, I said, oh, they're really good. I do many deals with them. They're good, but let me tell you why I'm better. They're good, but let me tell you what I do different.
Mm-hmm.
They're good, but let me tell you why I'm going to get this job done for you and why you should go with me. I never will knock a competitor to a potential client. And I've been one of our biggest issues to overcome is when someone says, well, why should we go with you, Brad, at Major Properties? There's Lee and Associates and CBRE and Dom and Grubb and Ellis and all these others. I said, well, you could hire a name or you could hire me. Those are great names. Who do you know over there? And they might not know anybody. They say, well, I don't know yet, but you know me, and you know the service you're going to get from me is exceptional. So there's always answers to objections, and thinking about objections that you're going to get and knowing the answers before you're asked the question is probably a smart thing to do versus not thinking, what would this guy possibly ask me? But actually being prepared before you go into a meeting as best you can.
Yes.
When you've done it so much, it just snaps in your head immediately. And the other thing I tell all these agents that are trying to get listings or do more business is you have to experiment. You experiment with your sales style, technique, and things that you say, and try things. Try different things and see how it works and analyze, did it work, did it not work? But You have to be a little bit of a gambler to be a broker. First off, you're not getting a check. You're not getting a salary. You only get paid if you can make a deal, and you only can make a deal if you're in a deal. There's so many steps to getting paid. But if you're not a gambler, you're not going to make as many deals as the guys that are taking risk and taking the challenges and getting outside of the box.
Let me mention something else here, too, because what you said about, you know, not bad-mouthing or putting down your competitors is so important, because when they bring up the name of somebody that they're thinking of listing with or working with, that means that in their mind they have already decided that this is a broker or a brokerage company that has made the grade for them to be considering working with. Now, if you start to put them down, okay, now you're basically, you know, throwing a monkey wrench into their feeling about their own judgment, and they're kind of going, who is this broker telling me that my judgment is bad and wrong and incorrect? And that's not a good place to start occupying in their mind, where they're thinking, you know, you don't, you know, understand how smart and intelligent I am. You've just told me that I'm wrong for even considering these people. Not a good place to be coming from. So what you talked about was so important in terms of that acknowledgement of, you know, yes, they're good, but let me tell you why we're better. You go into alignment with their feeling of their own good judgment about these people, but now you're going to segue into why you're a better choice. It's brilliant in the way it should be done.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important, because that comes up all the time. And sometimes you'll win and sometimes you'll lose, and that's just the nature of our business. And that's it. Yeah.
There's a broker who I've coached, actually a great, brilliant guy. Actually, he's out of Texas, but he managed the Marcus & Millichap office in downtown for a while, a guy named Scott LaMontagne. And I remember he told me one time that, you know, when he was running a sales meeting, he asked one of his longtime brokers to get up there and give a presentation on prospecting. And he said, we're in the room, and he's got screenshots of when he called this one particular prospect over and over again. And the result over the years, you know, was really rude, hung up on me, told me not to call back, told me he doesn't have any needs and I'm wasting my time, and on and on and on, year after year. And then finally the final entry was listed as property today, okay? And you talked about this earlier. I mean, you know, people really need to have an underlying, you know, need or reason to do something, to sell, for example, okay? And if they're standing pat and everything is fine and they're happy with the property and the rent and everything like that, they don't need you. Some people are ruder than others in terms of how they're going to communicate that to you. But something can change in their life, a divorce where they got to divide the property, you know, a dissolution of partnership, basically, a desire to get out of one type of property and into another property, or maybe in a different location, city or state, you know, or a desire to start to, you know, divide up and make the money more liquid for the kids or estate planning. And you never know when that's going to go on. And clearly something happened in that owner's life where now he was ready, whereas before he was very dismissive to brokers over and over again because he saw no need to have him in his life. And you never know when that moment in time is going to happen. And understand that when owners or any prospects are rude and hang up to brokers, most of the brokers are going to drop off from even calling them over the years. So now when you do, and you have that persistence, and you're willing to put up with that rejection, you're one of very few brokers, if any, who are still going to be calling that person. So you'll be in prime shape to get the listing or do business with them if and when that moment in time comes when they say, yes, we need to do something now.
Jim, 2 weeks ago, one of my guys identified a property that was vacant, and he looked up the ownership, and he asked me to help him. I said, okay, let's go. We got in the car. We drove to the guy's house. I go knock on the guy's door. The wife answers the door. I said, hi. I put my card out so, you know, they kind of like aren't scared. And I'm Brad Lester. I'm with Major Properties. Is Mr. So-and-so home? Yeah. And hold on. She closes the door. The door opens. He comes to the door. He halfway cracks it. How could I help you? I said, I'm Brad Lester. Blah, blah. How'd you find me? I show him the paperwork, property profile from First American Title. I'm explaining this from First American Title. And look, here's your name and there's your home address right there. I said, I couldn't find your phone number, so I thought I'd come knock on your door. I noticed your building's been empty for 3 months and there's no sign on it. So he goes, yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do. He closes the door. I start to walk to my car. He opens the door. He goes, tell me, what do you think my property is worth? Right? So now I said, okay, well, I said, I think your property is worth about $4 million. He goes, really? I said, yeah. And I think I could sell it for you if you were interested. He goes, okay, thank you. And he closes the door. I'm walking a little closer to my car down his driveway. The door opens again, and he's got a few other questions for me. So I scratched my head. I said, this is interesting. Okay. I left my card. That was it. So a week and a half goes by. He calls me up. He calls me on a weekend. He goes, hey, Brad, I thought you were going to give me an opinion of value on both my properties. I said, yeah, I was going to do that. And I'm sorry, I got a little busy, but I'll definitely get that to you by Tuesday. And he was like, okay, well, let me give you my email. I know I gave it to you. This guy never gave me his email. He never gave me his phone number, but I got it because he called me on my cell phone on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So I got his cell phone now, and now I got his email, and he seemed a little confused. And I didn't even know about his second property. He gave me the street. So I did two opinion of values on Monday, and I FedExed it to him Monday night. And I'm planning to call him tomorrow to make sure he got it and see if he had any questions. And I also included listing agreements in there. So I don't know what's going to happen, if he's just shopping to get a loan or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, I still go to people's houses and knock on their doors.
That's great.
The easiest deals are these properties that have an owner sign on it or no sign on it, and they have distress. Half the property is empty, or more than half the property is empty, and people just don't manage their property. It's shocking to me, in such an amazing market or any market, that people leave their properties in such disarray, and those are just like free invitations, free inventory for a creative broker to go get a deal.
Absolutely. Let me just mention here to everybody what we're going to be talking about on the next three teleconferences in the next 3 months. Next month in September, we're going to be talking about becoming a master commercial real estate dealmaker. You know, expert brokers like Brad know how to put transactions together and move them forward, whereas other people that are mediocre or struggling can do things that get in the way that cause the deal to crater and fall apart, whereas a seasoned broker who understands psychology and what to do will close many more transactions rather than have the transactions fall apart that might happen with a mediocre agent. So we're going to talk about that in September. In October, it's going to be closing your prospects on becoming your clients. We're going to talk about what to do from the moment you first identify a prospect, you know, all the way up to getting them to be sold on you as the one broker they want to have represent them either on the listing or to represent them to buy and lease property, because that's an important part from step one to basically endear these people and stand out, like some of the things Brad's been talking about tonight. So they go, you know, this broker is different. This broker is a class act. We want to work with this broker. And then in November, it's going to be all about keeping your clients unbelievably loyal to you, doing what will have you get constant repeat business over time instead of having to bird dog new people for the rest of your career and you're not getting constant repeat business and referrals from the people you've previously worked with and closed transactions with. So, in wrapping up here, my friend, you've done a tremendous job. I mean, this has been, I've done this interview on this subject many times over the years, usually once a year. So I've probably done this 13, 14 times, I would say. And your take on this has been so wonderful and so different and so great because it's relationship oriented. It's taking care of the customer oriented and standing out in their mind as a class act and a friend and somebody who cares. You got anything you want to say as we're wrapping up? Final words of wisdom to everybody as we're about to complete the call?
I'm happy you asked me that because there's one thing I didn't mention that I think will make the difference for everyone listening to this cast. Dress the part. I know that in L.A. and a lot of markets, everybody's dressing down. We took off the ties, but we still wore jackets. Now we don't wear jackets. Some people are coming with jeans and a dress shirt, collared shirt. I got to tell you that the people that have the money want to be impressed. And you were talking about teams that went in with ties and or safari outfits. That's all cool, but especially young agents, trying to break in and take business away from old agents, wear a suit and a tie. Mm-hmm. Make a good-looking impression. I'll tell you, there's a broker. His name's Tim Bauer. He's like a top broker, CBRE. Been for years. And one of my dearest friends, a guy named Alan Schumann that owned the Palladium in Hollywood, they used Tim Bauer. And one of the things, aside from his brokerage abilities, that Alan was impressed with, he said it, every event, at every meeting, and even in social events, this guy is always dressed immaculately. He's always dressed impressively, that he's a consummate professional. And he goes, I remember that about him. And I really push my agents to dress appropriately and stand out from their competitors. Kids are coming out now from college or just coming into brokerage, and they're just, you know, loose with loose collars and untucked shirts. And, you know, it's okay to have the fancy socks because that's a discussion. Look at these socks, you know. But the point is dress the part and you'll have an advantage over your competitors that aren't dressing anymore.
Absolutely. And it's always been my feeling along those lines that, you know, it's much safer to slightly overdress than it is to slightly underdress because people will understand it, they'll appreciate it. And in most areas, you know, especially the major cities, a suit and tie is something appropriate that people will understand. Whereas in all honesty, if you're, you know, selling ranches out in the country and stuff like that, you know, jeans, a Western shirt, boots, and a cowboy hat with a nice, big, beautiful truck might be appropriate. But especially in the major cities, you're right on with this. And it's always safer to overdress than underdress. So beautiful. 100%. So I greatly, greatly appreciate you, Brad, taking the time to do this with us. It's just been wonderful. I think we've gained some great insight from what you had to say, and that story about how you began doing business with the Loomer family, to me, is priceless.
I'll remember that forever.
Yeah, I just think that's awesome, and just a perfect example of what a broker can do by choosing to be different and going in alignment with how an owner sees things and their negative opinion of brokers, and acknowledging it and showing them how you're different and how you will protect them and make sure they're not paying money for tenants that go out of business. And it's just huge. So again, I thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I that story was just huge. So to everybody else, thanks for being on the call, and also to the people listening to the recordings when they're available. Thanks for being in the program. Remember, next month we're going to be talking about deal making and how to make sure you're doing what will maximize the probability of you closing your transactions. And until next month, I wish everybody the best of continued success, and we'll talk then. Take care and good night.